The journalist Catherine Boo won acclaim writing about poor people in America for The Washington Post and The New Yorker. Then she began writing about poor people in a single neighborhood in the vast Indian city of Mumbai. Did you know at the beginning what you were looking for when you began reporting this book?
I was so completely clueless when I started this book.
Catherine Boo became a regular visitor to Mumbai after she married a man from India. The result is her new book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers. She tells the story of one of the world's largest cities while keeping a narrow focus. She writes of one struggling young man who is trying to make a living when he is falsely accused of setting a neighbor woman on fire. In this neighborhood called Anawadi, Catherine Boo examines what she calls the infrastructure of opportunity for people in the developing world.
We talk a lot about infrastructure in cities, and it's talking about highways, and it's talking about trains. But I think more important to people who are low income is, how do I get from here to there? How do I become part of the affluence that's surrounding me? That, I think, is a question of the infrastructure of opportunity.
Now, I love the way that you phrase that question. How do I become part of the affluence that's surrounding me?
Mm-hmm.
Because you chose a neighborhood that is, in fact, surrounded by affluence. I mean, not like miles away. People look out of the front of their homes, and there's a Western-style hotel.
There's a Hyatt. There's an Intercontinental. There's a Sheraton. A few of the kids have actually broken the barrier between the slum world and the rich one. I talk about a kid who gets a temp job bussing dirty plates and bagging trash at a Bollywood party.
Suddenly he's middle class, practically.
Exactly. And then, of course, the job ends 2 days later, and he's back in the slum. But that's the way we work now.
And this is a neighborhood that is near the Mumbai airport.
Yes.
It must be a neighborhood that millions of people, including, no doubt, people listening to us now, who have, you know, come out of that airport and driven by on the road and never noticed it. If you turn into that neighborhood, what's it like? What do you see?
You turn at this wall. There was a long wall advertising ceramic floor tiles that said, beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever. And the advertisements were for the clientele of the airport. But if you went past that wall, you get a road that was really more crater than dirt, and you turn inside, and you'd see this slum where thousands of people were living in, on top of, outside of makeshift huts. And the whole slum sat on this vast beachfront of sewage lake. It was a lake of sewage and illegally dumped construction materials. It was a breeding ground for malaria, dengue, and other health hazards. And most of the people in the slum were making their living by buying and reselling the recyclable garbage of the rich people who lived all around the slum. In that slum, only 6 people out of 3,000 had permanent work. So every day, people were getting up and saying, here I am in my piece of the global economy. Now, how do I take what I can do and try to convince the world that that's what they need?
What are some of the ways that people make a living, characters in your book?
Well, many of them buy and sell recyclable garbage. At the airport every morning at dawn, thousands of scavengers go out around the airport area, and they pick up pieces of the city's vendable excess, plastic bottles, old newspapers, old cans, metal scrap. And then they collect that and sell that by the kilo. There are other people who are taking plastic remnants off of clothespins, work that they get paid by the kilo. Some people are stitching quilts. Some people are stringing marigolds on a thread. And some people are trying to get into the overcity, as I call it, the more prospering city, by trying to figure out how some of the corruption around them might be turned to their advantage.
Did it frighten you or intimidate you at first to take on a project like this? To be a foreigner going in to study people who are not quite at the bottom, but very near the bottom in India.
Yeah. And there were so many times when I was reporting in Anawadi that I would just come home and cry because I didn't think that I was going to be able to bring the stories to the page in a way that would make other people care. Whether it's in an Oklahoma City housing project or a colonial in South Texas or a housing project in Washington, D.C. or a slum in Mumbai, you go in and you start to care about people and you start to see what happens to them, and maybe something happens and you just can't go away because you are completely invested in understanding where the story is going to go. When a kid like Abdul, who is supporting a family of 11 by buying and selling the things that richer people throw away, when a kid like that gets falsely accused of setting a disabled woman on fire and gets launched into this incredible web of a corrupt justice system, You didn't say, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to go home now and go to Whole Foods and buy some cheese. You just have to find out what's happening.
Do you think it was actually an advantage to be an outsider, trying to learn this story and tell it?
No, I don't think so. You know what it's like to work in a place where you don't know the culture as much as you want, where you are using translators instead of just sitting across from somebody the way we're sitting together now. And so no, I don't think.
I understand all that. But at the same time, maybe you're asking basic questions that people who are insiders haven't asked themselves in a long time.
When I first started talking about to people about some of the issues that I was finding, people would be like, oh, yeah, it's all corrupt. Of course it's going to be like that. And to me, I was like, no, wait, it doesn't have to be like that.
You're saying that you were not willing to assume that everything was decided, that everything was fated for the poor, and that they were all the same.
Right.
You wanted to see the gradations, the nuances between different people and different lives.
Right, exactly, exactly. And I think that there's some way in which we would prefer not to see very clearly the immense gifts and intelligence of some of the people who live in our most abject conditions. Because most of us who are sitting here talking about the world and the meritocracy or how people get ahead, well, maybe we kind of think, hey, we worked hard, we got there. And if you start to think about the people who are working harder than I, for instance, have ever worked, and start to think that they have real intelligences and real moral judgments and are extraordinary people in many, many ways, you know, maybe then you have to say, gosh, well, did I actually deserve to get here? Or maybe there are some things at work in deciding who gets to be society's winners and who gets to be society's losers that don't have to do with merit.
Catherine Boo is the author of Behind the Beautiful Forever. Thanks very much for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.
When writer and journalist Pamela Druckerman became a mother, she expected to spend the next few years frantically meeting her daughter's every demand. But living abroad in Paris, she found a whole new method of parenting, one she shares in a new book. Critic Marcela Valdez has this review.
In the U.S., after all, mealtimes, living rooms, and sleep schedules typically turn to chaos as soon as a baby arrives. But as an American in Paris, Druckerman noticed a series of what she calls minor miracles. Parents who enjoy long adult conversations while their children play quietly nearby. And perhaps most surprising of all, babies, lots of them, who sleep through the night at just 2 or 3 months old. Scenes like these inspire Druckerman to write her marvelous new book, Bringing Up Bébé. Druckerman has investigated and distilled the essentials of French child rearing. First among them is the French belief that even babies are rational creatures with a capacity to learn self-control. Second is their conviction that it's better for everyone, parents and kids, if children adapt to adult routines. As one French psychologist explains, the child must learn from a very young age that he's not alone in the world and that there's a time for everything. Druckerman provides fascinating details about French sleep training, feeding schedules, and family rituals. But her book's real pleasures bring from her funny, self-deprecating stories. One of the book's few flaws is her tendency to downplay the role government has had in cultivating parents' so-called intuition. Is it really a coincidence that the Parisian way of introducing solid foods matches the instructions in a government pamphlet? And she only hints at the ways French schools inhibit creativity as children grow older. Surrounded by adults who can't resist gobbling their own slices of cake, children can hardly be expected to do any better.
Marcela Valdez is a board member of the National Book Critics Circle. And while we're on the subject of books, get ready for the latest installment in NPR's Backseat Book Club for Kids. Photography is at the heart of our next book, Shooting Kabul by N.H. Senzai. And this time, we not only want to hear your questions, but also to see your photos. To find out how you can get involved, go to npr.org/backseat.
The British novelist Robert Harris writes thrillers that are usually in one way or another about power. That's true whether he writes about Roman politicians or a disgraced former British prime minister. As he wrote his latest novel, Harris was thinking of George Orwell's 1984. That book described how governments use technology to dominate their people. The latest story from Harris explores technology that almost seems under its own power. Real life provided inspiration one day in May 2010.
A shaky day on Wall Street, to say the least.
I don't know. There is fear. This is capitulation, really.
It's also exacerbated by computerized selling and
It's a fast market.
Those are news reports from what's now known as the flash crash. The Dow plunged, then rose, in part due to lightning-fast computer-generated trades. Robert Harris had found the Frankenstein for his latest novel, The Fear Index. It's the story of a hedge fund, a scientist, and his computer run amok.
I started writing the novel in the beginning of 2010, and I thought that I needed in it to see this computer causing some financial mayhem. And on the evening of the 6th of May 2010, I happened to turn on the television to find that exactly the event I'd been trying to imagine in my novel was actually taking place in the United States. Wall Street went over a cliff and lost about 700 points in about 8 minutes. And it wasn't until months later they could work out precisely what had happened. And that is why I have this sense in the novel that the thing has come alive. And I think a lot of us feel, when we look at the Dow Jones plunging, alienated, you do feel as if we're in the grip of some alien force that slipped human control. And it was that I was trying to get at in the novel.
How is it that human fear is mixing with this technology and the incredible speed of information?
Well, in the end, it's human beings who still sell most of the stock, and therefore, if there is a feeling of jitteriness creeping around the markets, that is reflected. And what the algorithm, the fictional algorithm in the novel does, is scour the internet for incidences of fear-related words. And when I wrote this, I thought I was making it up. But then when I finished the novel, I then discovered this is happening, quite common, actually. Trending on Facebook, Twitter, and so on is read by the algorithms, and that is factored in to their calculations as to what shares to buy.
You mean that if suddenly people on Twitter are talking about violence in an oil-producing country or just seeming anxious, that could actually move the markets?
Yes.
So you have this American scientist, this computer genius, Hoffman, who has developed algorithms that play on fear, that work on fear and try to anticipate how that'll move markets and make billions of dollars as a result. And I wonder if you could read a passage here.
Sure.
From the book. This is him giving a little bit of a speech to potential investors, I believe.
Yeah. Although Hoffman had tried to avoid jargon, he had nevertheless sensed a growing bafflement among his audience. But now he had their attention, no question. He continued, "Fear is historically the strongest emotion in economics. Remember FDR in the Great Depression? It's the most famous quote in financial history. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. In fact, fear is probably the strongest human emotion, period. Whoever woke at 4 a.m. because they were feeling happy. It's so strong, we've actually found it relatively easy to filter out the noise made by other emotional inputs and focus on this one signal. One thing we've been able to do, for instance, is correlate recent market fluctuations with the frequency rate of fear-related words in the media. Terror, alarm, panic, horror, dismay, dread, scare, anthrax, nuclear. Our conclusion is that fear is driving the world as never before."
I started getting tense just listening to that list of words. Why is it that you choose to have the guy who invents this machine that gets out of control? Why do you make him an American?
Purely because the financial markets are completely international. All the characters are various nationalities, as in Indians, Chinese, British. He doesn't have to be American. Essentially, he belongs to the international community of the geek or the nerd. He sits and he mumbles and he's not very good with people and it doesn't matter. I mean, his nationality isn't terrifically important.
Let me ask this. I don't want to give away anything about the ending of this novel, which has a lot of twists and turns, but let me just ask this question in a general way. Do you have some anxiety in real life that we could end up in some way almost worshipping machines, computers specifically, artificial intelligence?
Yes, I think that, and I don't think that we will see it coming until it's too late. And already one feels with the markets that supposedly these machines are working for us, they're supposed to make the markets more efficient and so on. But there is a sense in which one feels that human beings have started to work for the machine. Our view of machines taking over was Howell in 2001. And the,
Stanley Cooper.
You have to think, I think, differently about how this might operate. And it will operate through millions of computers linked together, making calm and rational decisions. It's not alive in any recognizable sense. And yet, in a strange way, it's determining our existence. And it's also slightly outside human control. I mean, one cannot see any world leader that's got a grip on the financial markets these days. They're too big, too fast. I think that's quite scary.
I'm trying to think of the different stories that you've come by to talk with us about over the years. You have written novels about the Roman Empire. You wrote a novel about a very familiar-seeming British prime minister. Now you're writing about the present day and where we might be headed in the future. What obsesses you throughout all these books? What is it you're driving at with such different stories?
Power, I think, probably. I was a political journalist. I came to writing novels through an interest in politics and power. And I think I just, like a butterfly hunter, I pursue it wherever I happen to see it. And now I think that if you want to write about power, go and look at computers, go and look at the financial markets. It seems to me there's more, it's nearer the cutting edge of what's guiding our lives now than conventional political parties. So I think that that's what drew me to it. It was this Orwellian notion of what it is to be human and what are the things that are constantly acting on us from cradle to grave that shape the way we live. We all want to live as individuals and make our own choices, and to a large degree we do, but there's always pressures around us to shape us. And I think the shaping force is no longer the state, but very much technology and corporations and money.
The latest novel by Robert Harris is called The Fear Index. Thanks for coming by.
Been a pleasure.
When he was 30 years old, David Finch's wife, Kristen, sat him down and asked him a series of questions. Do you notice patterns in things all the time? Do people comment on your unusual mannerisms and habits? Do you feel tortured by clothes tags, clothes that are too tight or made in the wrong material? Do you sometimes have an urge to jump over things? Well, David's answers to all of these questions and more than 100 others was an emphatic yes. Kristen Finch had just given her unsuspecting husband a self-quiz to evaluate for Asperger's syndrome, a condition on the autism spectrum. Her own score was 8 out of a possible 200. David's was 155. When they confronted the result, she told him, "That's a whole lot of Asperger's." And it helped to explain why their marriage of 5 years was falling apart. Now David Finch has written a book about how he and Kristen work to overcome his compulsions and sometimes antisocial behavior. It's titled The Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger's syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband. David and Kristen Finch join me from Chicago. Thanks to you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear from both of you your reaction to that moment when you realized what you were dealing with, that David likely had Asperger's. What went through your mind?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people ask me, gee, that must have been shocking or unsettling. And it really wasn't like that. For me, it was very cathartic. It was this unbelievable moment of self-recognition. It gave me such insight into who I am, how my mind works, and why certain things had been such a challenge.
Kristen, did you have that same sense of relief that David's describing?
I did. Definitely my first thought was, of course, how could I have missed it for so long? How could I have missed all these signs? I mean, I'm trained in working with children on the autism spectrum and Asperger's, and now, you know, here I'm living with this for years and years, and it was right there in front of me, and it just made sense all of a sudden. Everything came together, and all of the things that were starting to ruin our marriage, everything kind of had a reason now.
And Kristen, I mean, you mentioned your bewilderment. How could I have missed that? Some of the things that David describes of his patterns and habits, that, you know, groceries had to be bought from a certain store two towns away, that he couldn't read the newspaper ever. He was too distracted by the texture of the paper itself. How did you account for that? What was your explanation to yourself before you knew that this was Asperger's?
I knew for sure, looking back, that there was some obsessive compulsive pieces to him. And I knew he was quirky. He was always quirky since high school when we were friends. He's always just done things a little bit different. And it's one of the things that I loved the most about him. I think I was able to deal with it because usually the things that he did were hidden from me. You know, the social pieces, I knew that he didn't love to go out. I knew that he didn't love barbecues and things like that. But I had no idea before the quiz that it wasn't that he didn't enjoy it. It was that he found it very difficult to do these things.
Yeah, and that was something that was frustrating for me, too. You know, the nature of Asperger's is such that it can reveal itself to you, yourself, and to the people around you very slowly. I was always able to maintain these characters, these great versions of myself that I knew would fit
right.
any social environment. You know, for as much difficulty as I have sometimes understanding where someone's mind is at, I do a remarkably good job of analyzing people and observing them and then mimicking those behaviors like a chameleon, you know, socially. The problem is now we're married and we're living together all the time. And then we had kids, and Kristen was struggling as a first-time mom. And now she can see, she realizes, oh my gosh, okay, my husband has no idea how to help me right now or support me. And so I think the disorder revealed itself to both of us slowly over time. But since we didn't know what it was, it just looked like I was becoming more and more selfish, mm-hmm. less and less tuned in and responsive to her needs.
Well, David, as you confront this realization that you have Asperger's, you start writing things down that you need to do to change. You call it your journal of best practices. And it's things like don't change the radio station when she's singing along. It sounds like notes were piling up all over the place on anything, a napkin, a post-it note.
So what I started doing was I started really paying attention, and I started just writing things. I had to write it down, otherwise I would forget. What the Journal of Best Practices was essentially was a collection of these notes that I would scribble down frantically on the backs of envelopes and post-it notes. The sort of things I was writing down were like, let Kristen shower in the morning without crowding her. Give the kids vitamins without asking Kristen a million steps and directions on how to do that. Then there were other things that had really nothing to do with Asperger's that were just being a better husband, encouraging her interests, using my words, which was essentially Kristen's speech therapist way of telling me, you have to talk. You have to come and talk to me when things are bothering you. So, you know, there was some overlap. Some things were just general best practices as a husband, and other things were things that I can do to manage the Asperger behaviors better.
David, how do you think the kids are going to be processing your behavior? You describe yourself in the book of putting on swim goggles and a bathing suit just to give them a bath because you have sensory issues, right, with water.
Right. I hate being splashed, quite frankly. I hate unsolicited wetness. Right now, the kids think it's the greatest. They've got this dad that is kooky and makes them laugh. Emily is six. Our daughter Emily is six. Our son Parker is four. Parker really couldn't care less what's happening around him as long as he's got a truck to play with. He's happily oblivious. Emily is tuned in. Mm. She's paying attention. And so one of my best practices was allow the children to participate in your daily routines. This is very difficult for me because it's always a disaster when the kids get involved. And so I invited her to help me make eggs one morning. And I noticed that she had my sequence down pat. Open the door, get the eggs out. She lined it up perfectly, exactly on the edge of the counter where I always put the carton of eggs. And here's where I started getting freaked out was when she started filling up the water. When it was time to fill up the pot for hard-boiled eggs, she closed the faucet, opened it, closed it, opened it, closed it, tapped her forehead, opened it, and closed it the same way that I do. And she's like that, Daddy? And I was like, no, sweetie, no.
You don't have to do that.
No, please don't do that.
What do you think, Kristen? Is there going to be some explaining to do?
I think there may be some explaining to do, but I think it's kind of a good lesson, I guess, in that, you know, that's just how Daddy does things. We don't have to do it that way. Everyone doesn't do it that way, but that's the way, you know, that's the way Daddy does things.
Well, David and Kristen Finch, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's our
Thank
pleasure.
Thank you.
David and Kristen Finch. David's book is The Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger's syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband.
The social scientist Charles Murray writes this in his new book, "Our nation is coming apart at the seams, not ethnic seams, but the seams of class." Murray's book is in fact called Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. Over the past half century, he argues, white Americans have come to include a new upper class, defined more than ever before by education, and a new lower class, characterized by the lack of it. And the new lower class is also less industrious, less likely to marry and raise children in a two-family household, and less connected to the rest of society. By focusing on whites, Murray tries to correct the assumption that these are markers of the American racial divide. Charles Murray is a libertarian, and his previous books include Losing Ground and The Bell Curve, a rather controversial book about IQ as a determinant of many socioeconomic outcomes. And he joins us today. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
To the program. First, since we Americans love to consider ourselves middle class, whether we're factory workers or neurosurgeons, how big do you figure the new upper class is and how big is the new lower class?
Well, if you talk about the upper middle class, which is a subset of the new upper class, you're talking about 20% of the white adult population. And the white working class these days represents about 30% of the white adult population.
And they are separated both geographically and also culturally.
Both of those. There has developed over the last 50 years distinctive tastes and preferences among people who share high levels of education and also are affluent. This involves everything from the way they raise their children to the foods they eat, the way they take care of their bodies, the cars they drive, you name it. In addition to that, there has been an increasing spatial separation, so that you have zip codes that have levels of affluence and education that are so much higher than the rest of the population that they constitute a different kind of world. And these, in terms, form clusters.
One surprise that emerges from your data is that the new upper class, people who might often be ridiculed as latte liberals, contemptuous of traditional values, are, in fact, the people who are getting and staying married more. They're the people who continue to go to church or synagogue more. They work more hours. They are exemplars of traditional American values.
It's strange because we think of the upper middle class, for example, as being secular, that they've fallen away from religion. Well, it turns out that the upper middle class goes to church more often and feels a much stronger affiliation with their religion than the white working class.
You feel this is a dangerous situation, that the white upper middle class, the educated middle class, is so separate from the bottom percent.
I think it's potentially very dangerous because, let's face it, the people who run the country have enormous influence over the culture, the politics, and the economics of the country. And increasingly, they haven't a clue about how most of America lives. They have never experienced it. They don't watch the same movies. They don't watch the same television shows. And when that happens, you get some policies that are pretty far out of whack.
I guess the question that I had in reading Coming Apart is truly how different this is, how different today is from the past. And it seems to me that by contrasting today, which I think you describe pretty well, with 1960, or in the preface actually 1963, seems to me you've chosen not the way we used to be, but the way the country was at a high point of leveling, unifying experiences. My father and all the other fathers had been in the Second World War. They'd experienced the Depression at one age or another. They'd come through the GI Bill. Nobody seemed to object to hugely high tax rates. It was a time which I would think was remarkably unified, and to my reading provides perhaps a false baseline for how much worse things are today as previously in our history.
You could actually make an argument that even earlier in the century there was even greater mixture of the different classes, and a lot of that was done by lodges. You know, the Elks and the Moose and you name it. There were lots and lots of these which took people in from all social classes, and people were proud of that. Also, you have the 1800s, and Alexis de Tocqueville saying, you know, the funny thing about America is that the more opulent members of the society take great care to talk to the members of the lower classes every day and keep in close touch with them.
I was thinking of say, 1923, if that had been a baseline for where we are today, as opposed to 1963, huge immigrant nativist differences, communities that were utterly apart, linguistically apart from one another, Catholics and Protestants divided on a basic thing like prohibition, urban tenement living, as opposed to what was still a very large population of small farmers in the country. I'd have thought we'd say, well, back then we were far more divided.
There's a way in which that was different in an important respect, which is almost all the people who were successful in 1923 had started out in the working class family or a middle class family. Very few of them were second or third generation affluent. And so when you got, for example, Eisenhower's cabinet in 1952, it was called Nine Millionaires and a Plumber in the popular press. And they were nine millionaires and a plumber. But all those nine millionaires, I think with one exception, had grown up, you know, as farmers' sons or small merchants' sons and so forth.
But, you know, I took note of what you wrote about Eisenhower's cabinet. You said all but two had not been born into affluent families. So today, not including the small business administrator who was given a new chair last week, there are 15 cabinet secretaries. By another measure, there are four women, two Asians, one black, two Latinos. One could say this is a group, by today's measure, who are immeasurably more diverse than Eisenhower's cabinet secretaries.
Oh, it's definitely more...
gender and ethnic.
Gender and ethnically diverse, but not socioeconomically.
What should the attitude, as you see it, of the new upper class be toward the new lower class? I understand you better. Should it be, I have some lessons to teach you? What's the stance between the one and the other?
The new upper class should drop its non-judgmentalism. I want the new upper class to start preaching what it practices. They are getting married and staying married in large numbers. They work like crazy, long hours. They even do better going to church than lots of the rest of America. Why not just say these are not just choices we have made for ourselves. These are rich, rewarding ways of living.
I just want to ask you before you go about the decision to write about white America. It would be akin, one could say, to saying I'm going to write about Britain, but I'm not going to talk about the class system at all. Was this entirely a matter of trying to pre-butt people who would say, well, he's talking about blacks? Or were you in fact saying, after the bell curve, maybe I'd better not write about blacks. People will receive what I write so unfavorably. I'll just talk about white people.
I wanted to limit it to whites to concentrate the minds of my readers. When we talk about a lot of the social problems that are in the book, the reflexive response is, oh, well, you know, those problems are really a lot worse in the black community or in the Latino community than in the white community. And this way, I can say throughout the book, just put that all out of your minds. Yeah. These are problems in the white community. However, in the penultimate chapter of the book, I say, suppose we put everybody in the mix. What do these trend lines look like?
You say it's the same thing.
Guess what, folks? It looks just the same.
Well, Charles Murray, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Charles Murray is the author of Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010.